Well, good. Fine is what we aim for.
Yes, yes. Did you get the coasters and the plastic cups?
What?
Because
you didn't actually send those to me, did you?
No. I was... I don't have your address. I told you to send me your address. No,
I was incredibly sleepy. Don't make references to jokes that you made on the internet when I was, like, completely unconscious.
Oh, well, I know you were tired. And then yeah. I was tired, and that's why I was making dumb jokes. But
here's how tired I was. Yesterday, after our second day of shooting, I was just sort of chilling on the couch, like, before I was going to get ready for bed, and I saw the 9.0.2 update on the iPhone or whatever. So I hit update, and then I sort of just, like, nestled into the couch for a minute, and then I woke up a half hour later, and Amanda said she had been poking me in the face, like, 10 or 15 times, and I wasn't moving or responding. I was just snoring loudly, so I was apparently so unconscious that you could poke me in the face.
Wow. Sounds like you need a vacation. But you should probably just stay at home and not go to your lake house cottage.
I mean it's damp there, and then there's the kid with the big head who falls down the stairs, which is a weird thing.
It's not appropriate to make fun of somebody with that condition.
No, not at all. There's a name for that condition, evidently.
Yeah, hydrocephalic. But like the boy genius on Venture Brothers, unfortunately, suffers from that condition.
No, I thought he was just drawn that way, but that makes sense.
Yes. Well,
oh, God, the smell of this microphone is seriously going to make me pass out or something.
That's weird, because I don't really think mine smelled.
Maybe it's just, like, because it was in the plastic, and then, you know, the Arizona heat kind of made the plastic
Did you like, literally just assemble it before the podcast? You didn't let it air out?
No, I didn't really let it air out, no.
Trust me, there is no Sharpie lingering smell over time. Maybe it's just a byproduct of the manufacturing process.
Oh yeah, I didn't think it was going to be like a permanent thing.
Like a permanent marker.
Yeah, a permanent marker. What was that? Did you just drop a permanent marker?
No, my neighbor apparently opened the door very loudly. I should probably go spy on them.
They're trying to open your door? Or,
No. And now the furnace is kicking in. No, but
does your furnace go to 5,000 degrees?
No, it doesn't.
That's not natural.
Mm-mm, no. What does a man need with that much heat?
Maybe he just likes a really good sear on his steaks.
Mm-hmm.
We're getting way ahead of ourselves.
Yes.
good week.
It is a week. It is a week, and that's... It's a week on Earth. That's what it is. So that's great.
Our incomparable radio theater episode came out this week.
Mm-hmm.
That was good. Mm-hmm. That was funny. I enjoyed it. I listened to it. We got a little preview early, and I quite enjoyed it.
Yeah. Wait. I have a question. Is this the show?
Yes, this is the show.
Oh, I didn't tweet it yet.
Oh.
I was waiting for you to tell me that the stream worked.
I told you that the stream worked.
No, you didn't say anything specific about that. Rye is probably, like, seeing this notification come up, and he's comically spilling some coffee, doing, like, a spit take. His chair he was leaning in falls backwards, and he scrambles for his phone. Like, that's what I imagine happens when a surprise live broadcast of our show happens.
He's so surprised that his hat literally flies off the top of his head. he's got good hat humor.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, it's warm. I took a drink of water.
It's fine. I think I blacked out for 5 seconds. All right, so now
we're just basically after this week, we're just basically in a fugue state here, and we're just gonna riff. We're just gonna go with it. It's gonna be weird stuff.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what's not weird about this show? But yes. What an interesting week. Full of things and
uh-oh.
Stuff. What?
Glenn just favorited the show announcement.
Oh, yes. Glenn was on last week. That's not this episode.
I really liked that episode. I listened to it two or three times. It's pretty good.
Yes. Well, Glenn is a charming guest.
Yeah, he is. He's a great guest. We should have him on again sometime.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
hopefully
at least,
not for Highlander 2.
No.
We'll find some other Sean Connery film for him to come on for.
Yeah, I mean, we got to find a movie that he has some personal story about, at least, because that's important, apparently.
Oh, I don't think that's really that hard to do. we can do that about anything. I'm pretty sure.
He has lived some kind of life to have those sorts of references about that many things.
Yes. Well, that is... I know you don't listen to The Incomparable, Dan, but...
From time to time.
Yes, well, Glenning goes back many years and spans the duration of that show. And basically any topic that gets brought up, there is some relation to his life. And so that is what makes it so charming and lovely that he's able to make these connections. And that's why it's known as Glenning. So, you know.
Yeah, it works for me.
So if listeners are listening to this and they have not listened to the other episode, please... Do that, because why are you skipping episodes, you jerks? These are all solid gold. Except for Snowpiercer, that was not a good episode. But the other
that's still on the movie channels these days. I see it going by on the Showtime or something every now and then. It's like, can we not? Can we just put that to bed now? People still like it though. Apparently, I don't get it. Whatever.
Oh no, it drives me nuts. Oh, and sometimes you'll see it like in like an internet meme or something. They'll be like, "Oh, this is all about like some societal comments." And you'd be like, "You idiots! That movie's horrible." But I have to ask though:
Are you doing it as a callback to our show canon, or did you literally just mispronounce meme again?
I think it was the second thing.
You're my favorite co-host on this show. You know that? No, but seriously.
Yes.
But seriously, folks, what's the deal with Airlife? Now that I've got this microphone that's shaped like a traditional Shure microphone, I feel like I should be doing a stand-up routine or something.
All the pressure is on you now. Now that you don't have a cartoon microphone, you can actually be the Seinfeld you were always meant to be. Although, I always pictured you as more of a Costanza.
Yeah, I got the glasses. I got some thinning hair. It's curly. I get uptight about a lot of things. Well, a lot of anxiety.
I think it's more the demeanor than the
grumpy
aspects.
Face. Yeah. As my family described it, the resting grumpy face.
Grumpy's a polite word for it, but
well, I mean, they were in the presence of my grandma, but that's what they were referring to.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Can't use any salty language in front of grandma. No. Yep.
She's a fan of sweet things. She makes cookies most of the time.
Okay. Not brownies that she drops on the floor and then gives to neighbors?
Something for the old sweet tooth. No, salty, more like sardines that you would put on a pretzel.
Oh, yes, because that's what pretzels need.
You know, of all of the things that I remember about this movie, which apparently we're just going to go completely out of order, but of the things that I remember about
are we talking about the movie now?
We're talking about the movie. The sound design of the sardine going onto the pretzel is one of those things that I will never unhear.
Oh, it's so good. Well, when you start listening to it and you first hear his fingers poking around inside the sardine tin, you're like, that is some good stuff right there. Like, they went extra, because you can tell that's Foley and that was not like an on mic thing. And then when he starts like really getting in there and really like trying to put it on, because there is a lot to what's actually happening for what is actually happening. And so when he's like trying to put it on top of the pretzel and it's still going like all over the place, and you're just like, Jesus Christ. And then that's some good stuff.
It's there for effect, but it works. Yeah. And then I just love that he eats the whole thing in one bite and just anyway, so we're talking about the Burbs. It's unclear from the show notes or the title of this episode.
Yes.
1989, not the Taylor Swift thingy mabob, but the movie with Tom Hanks and Bruce
Dern. Terrible apostrophe.
There's an apostrophe?
Yes.
Where's there an apostrophe? Oh, it's in front of I didn't even notice that.
How could you not notice in the title? Oh, God. Well, that drove me nuts. When the title comes up, they have the worst placement for that apostrophe, too. They apparently thought that they would set it out in space so that it is sort of like a mitered edge to the B and like floating out there. It is really an unattractive apostrophe placement.
Yeah, yeah. I guess they need Glenn to help them out with their typesetting.
Yes, they do.
But, yeah, you know, I don't think I've ever heard anyone refer to suburbs as the Burbs at any point in my life. And I've grown up in the suburbs my entire life, so that's...
Yeah, I've only heard suburbs jokingly referred to as the burbs. Most of the time, people don't even refer to it as being separate from the city or the metropolitan area that they live in. Speaking as somebody who lives in "quote unquote" Los Angeles, that is basically, you know, not really even a distinction.
Oh, that's another thing I was going to mention to you. since LA is literally the worst place in the entire world to live, you should guess how long it took me to get to work when I was going to the studio the past couple days. It was way longer than literally anything in LA. It took me 2 hours to get to work yesterday.
Wow.
The traffic in Phoenix, especially on the sort of southern centrally area there, is I can't even describe how bad it is. People drive 5 miles an hour for about 15 miles, and then it sort of speeds up a little bit and then it slows down again. The drivers here are the worst, and the traffic is as bad or worse than LA, but nobody will admit it because, you know, LA is just one of those places that's the worst, right?
Let's go back. So when you're talking about the big loopy freeway, right? The one that goes the whole way around?
There's a couple of them. I'm talking about the one that goes right through the center, the I-10.
Okay.
Like, when you get down to my neck of the woods, from central Phoenix down to my neck of the woods, it is it's only 6 lanes wide, and in the morning it goes 5 miles an hour at best for about 10-15 miles.
I mean, that's pretty normal for LA, but...
but it's Phoenix. And where are these people going?
I don't know. When the only time that I was in Phoenix, and that was remember that stupid resort vacation thing.
You weren't actually in Phoenix. You were in Cave Creek, which is in the middle of the desert. But sure.
Yeah. Well, I drove around the whole friggin' thing on whatever the big loopy one is.
Oh, you would have taken the 101 then, because that was up there in your neighborhood there, and it is referred to, yes, as the Loop 101, which goes all the way around.
Yeah. Well, then down to the Pizzeria Bianca that's down in the down part in the thing, and the that museum, the I can't remember the name of, that was in like downtown Phoenix, and I was like, oh my god, they have like light rail or trains or something.
The light rail has like 4 stops and it only goes in like, it's a straight line, but sure, there, it's there.
Yeah, well, I was just surprised that it was there at all. I was like, I thought this was a red state.
If you need to go from Arizona State's Tempe campus to Arizona State's downtown campus to Arizona State's West campus, yeah, there is the train for you. But other than that, it's not useful for anything else.
What are you talking about? You get the whole state. Ba-dum-bum.
Sure.
Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. Were you talking about higher education and not the entire state of Arizona?
Well, I don't know that I would call it higher education. It's education. I could make some sort of weed pun because they, you know, everyone there is a stoner, but no. Yeah, it's
No, I'm not. Never once.
No, at Arizona State.
Oh, that, yeah, sure, probably. I mean, gotta get your mind off things, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I know. I mean, there's only so much that can distract you from the brutal heat and insufferabilityism of the suburbs.
I thought that was what the meth was for.
No, the meth is out on the west side. That's not in Tempe.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the west side. That's way out there.
Okay.
Also suburbs / industrial.
Oh. Do they have an old Victorian house with peeling paint in the suburb that doesn't match anything else or have any real reason to be there?
No, all of the Victorian homes are in downtown Phoenix, actually. You may have driven past a few. They turn them into hipster coffee bars and restaurants. But yeah, how about that universal backlot in this movie here?
Yeah, it's super backlotty.
They point the camera in basically one direction of the. Is that the same street they shot Desperate Housewives on, you think?
I'm not sure, actually. I was just marveling at the hills every time that they cut to Bruce Dern on the roof, and you can very clearly see that you're in Los Angeles.
Yep. Yeah, I like that. Yeah. I think in the one or two shots that are shooting the other direction, like out of the cul-de-sac, it almost looks like you can see the Psycho house up on the hill that's like kind of blocked by a tree.
Oh, I didn't notice.
Yeah, it's shaped kind of funny.
I went on the tour once, though.
Only once?
Well, I mean, how many times do you need to go see houses in the Back to the Future Clock Tower?
But as many times as possible. That's where they shoot all of these big, fancy motion pictures. You get a piece of the action.
They didn't do it the one time that I went, Dan. That's the important part. And so now I have no reason to go back, because I can just assume that it was like that the rest of the time.
It probably was. But still,
also, all production is really in Vancouver now, so nobody's really filming there.
Well, that backlot is going to stay that way for historical purposes, mm-hmm. Because they shot The Burbs there, and The Burbs is a very famous movie that everyone loves.
Yes. This is the first time I've ever seen it.
That's very depressing to me.
I don't know why. It's one of those things where I had heard of it, and I think when I was a kid, I saw like the opening or something, where he's like unsure about taking a step onto the lawn or whatever, that thing. And so I was just like, this is weird. I don't want to watch this, and so I never watched it.
It was on TV a bunch. It is very weird, though, right? Because like tonally, it's a comedy/horror movie, and they kind of play back and forth a bunch on that. I totally forgot about that one moment, like where they start screaming no, and it does the repeating zooming in and out, like the cheesiest of cheesy horror movies.
I was very upset when that happened.
You can see they totally start laughing at the end of that shot, too.
I know, but it's one of those things where you might say it and be like, oh, this will be a fun idea, and then you think better of it later, but then nobody thought better of it later, so I don't know.
That's it's directed by your buddy.
Who's my buddy?
Joe Dante.
Oh. He's done other things.
He has. Especially in recent times.
And scores by Jerry Goldsmith. Very, very overzealous score. intrudes just a little bit into what's happening, but I quite like it.
The tone of it fits the all over the place ridiculousness of the movie, I find.
Yes, I agree. Especially the weird, like, out of nowhere Wild West stuff at the end, where it's sort of like an old like spaghetti western kind of style score, like you know, one of those old Clint Eastwood movies or something, all of a sudden.
You mean when he's like just slowly walking out of the burning house?
Yeah, and also when spoiler alert,
spoiling this movie from 1989.
I know, but why are we talking about the end of the movie first? All right, well, anyway, there's another cue later on when someone is defeated, so there that also plays again. And then a few times there's the like military, we're going to war kind of stuff. Which I think is kind of reminiscent of his Patton stuff or whatever.
Yeah, it's totally the Patton theme.
Yeah. And so, which Jerry Goldsmith also did. But then the majority of it is just sort of like all over the place in terms of like the one musical cue that's just a bunch of dogs barking on like a synthesizer. That one's weird. I don't know what he was thinking, but he's just like, I'm just gonna have fun and do some cocaine or something. But that was great.
I find it to be fun, like, you know, like when the car is creeping around, like the Klopek's car, or then when the furnace is on, just like pounding on the keys of the organ loudly to make it as like 50s horror kind of suspenseful trope music as they possibly can.
Oh yeah, well he can do that in spades. Like Gremlins, one of my other favorite films. He did the score for that, and it sort of has some similarities. Where
I'm pretty sure that was Dante as well, wasn't it?
I think it was. Yeah, because he did the sequel. I know he did the sequel because he confessed to that sin.
Gremlins, Inner Space, Gremlins 2. Let's see what else we got. Small Soldiers, of course.
Oh God, Small Soldiers.
And that, then most recently, Hawaii 5-0, Salem, Witches of East End.
Wait, so he's doing TV stuff?
Mm-hmm.
I worked on some Salem.
I know, that's why I brought it up.
Yeah.
That's why I said he's your buddy.
Well, he's not really my buddy, because I didn't really talk to him.
Well, you worked on his projects, is all I'm saying.
Well,
you have a close connection to this movie, whether you know it or not.
Actually, it was... I think that he wasn't really involved in the direction of the things that I was working on, Dan. I don't know if you know how TV works, but he's not like attached for all of the episodes.
Yeah. Well, you know, he's got the credit, so we're going to give him the credit.
Yeah. I recently found out this week that Carrie Fisher's daughter is in Scream Queens. So that was funny.
So you have another tie to this movie, because Well, it doesn't really.
No, that's a few degrees of separation too many.
I totally forgot Carrie Fisher was Tom Hanks' wife in this movie. I
forgot too, because I never knew. But
it's old Carrie Fisher when she looked like Carrie Fisher.
Well,
she's got the short hair.
Yeah,
well, I guess she still has short hair again, doesn't she?
She does, although I don't think it's this short. Especially, you know, at the end when she gets the new haircut, which is very important to him. but the I don't know. They didn't really like write her to do anything. She just kind of
she's right down the middle suburban wife. Like there's not much to the role other than be a rational human being that lives in the suburbs and has a child.
Yeah, she's not shrill and overbearing. Even though a few times they kind of like seem to want to make her out to be that way, and she's not super supportive and loving because she has arguments with him, and so it's just sort of this weird sort of neutral thing where they just don't really seem to do anything with her character at all through the whole film, even though that she's the wife of the main character. It's odd. And sort of an underutilization of Carrie Fisher, but she got to wear that dress at the top of the staircase for that one shot. so there's that, I guess. But she has some weird outfits in this too, because she had the thing with the what was it? It was like there was like a summer dress with like the flowers and stuff, but it was like an open thing, and then she had that weird like Victorian nightgown that she was wearing at the beginning of the movie. And you're just like, what is this about? Was she not like feeling up to going to wardrobe this morning or something? But I don't understand. Like the film is strange, and there's the kid. The kid means nothing in this movie. Zip, zilch, zero. He does nothing. He contributes nothing. Tom Hanks's character could care less about his child. Nothing about his home life matters to him in any conceivable way, even though he only wants to be at home, which is so weird.
So what you're saying is it is a 100% accurate depiction of suburban families.
I suppose. Only they're... well, I mean, they're not divorced, and it's not a second wife, so...
Well, that comes later. This is still the 80s, where The wife and child are just bland, nothing characters, and the father is bored and distracted and looks for literally anything to occupy his time, including his ridiculous, idiotic neighbor, Art.
Oh, I hate Art so much. I hate him.
It's kind of the point.
I know, but see, here's the thing, though. It's like, I know I'm supposed to hate Art, but I really hate Art. Like... I just despise the character.
so does Tom Hanks. That's kind of what he's there to do.
I know, but Tom Hanks goes along with it. So then, you know, who's more despisable?
Well, Tom Hanks goes along with it because, you know, his friend, he gives him the benefit of the doubt, but he finds his own evidence at some point.
Okay. I just don't like him. Also, I get the feeling that he's sort of, how should I put this politely? Because unfortunately the actor is dead, so I don't want to be a jerk, but... I get the feeling that he's sort of like a stand-in for Dan Aykroyd. Like they couldn't get Dan Aykroyd, so he was there.
Actually, Aykroyd would be a pretty phenomenal choice for that role. I don't know that he would have gone quite as slapsticky, but yeah, Aykroyd would have been great in this.
Yeah, he would have been electrifying. Spoiler alert.
Briefly, and just I love that he left an exactly human shaped hole in the roof of the little barn that he fell through in the backyard there.
That is Joe Dante's cartoonishness coming through there, which he also does in Gremlins and Gremlins 2, where characters make holes in things that are exactly the same size and shape as they are. So that was weird. But at the start of this film, we get sort of, I don't know, the suburban house kind of stuff. Like it's kind of like the opening of Poltergeist, where you got like the, you know, oh, it's just a nice little, you know, housing development. Everything's fine. Except for, you know, we have the little ominous thing with the Klopex and their house and the basement and the light and the noise and the stuff.
And I mean, they kind of get right into the problem statement of it all. Like, the opening shot is him rushing outside in the middle of the night while the light and the noise coming out of their basement, and then they do that stupid horror trope thing where he steps 1 foot across the property line and then the wind and leaves blow him back to his yard.
Yeah. Also, I have to say, from the opening shot of this film, having never seen this before, it was immediately clear to me that he was going to be in the basement by the third act of this film.
Yeah, you put a basement on the mantle in the opening shot?
Yes. Wait.
Sure. I mean, you know, yeah. It's an odd house.
What kind of mantle are we talking about here?
It's a metaphoric... how do metaphors work? I forget.
Well, you see, it's similar to... No. Well, what if it was like an Escher thing where you just like drew a mantle, but then it was like the perspective down into the basement? Wouldn't that just blow your mind, Dan?
Would David Bowie be there?
Sure, why not? And he'll like flip up onto it.
Yeah, actually, the face on the little the furnace down there kind of had a David Bowie's hairstyle from Labyrinth.
I thought it was supposed to look like the devil because it had horns.
Did it? I thought it had just like big like hair going above its head.
No, it had hair flying back, and then it had two horns, two like curly goat kind of horns.
Well, they do like to play up the pagan imagery in this because, of course, they're crazy psychotic people who
they're Satanists and they chant and they Satanists chant, and then I was just like, oh,
unconscious
God.
Chanting. Once they get into your head, man, they win.
Art, you. Dumb as a brick person.
But this is what happens when people have literally nothing in their lives other than like the cul-de-sac on which they live. They invent. This is not beyond the realm of possibility. I like that every bit of this movie kind of plays almost directly into stuff that probably would and does happen in the suburbs, of people just being bored out of their minds and looking way too deeply into stuff, all the way up until the point of just like the very end where, you know, they actually spin it a little bit, and there's actually some validity to the whole thing.
Well, yes. I mean, that goes without saying, because that's the whole point, is the premise that, you know, this is just like everywhere else, it's just like this, and you have one weird neighbor, and you don't trust him, and nobody else trusts him. Then all the neighbors gang up on the other neighbor, and there's all the politics with the wives and stuff. And so it's not beyond the realm of believability for some aspects of this. What is strange is the number of times in the film where people refer to each other by their names, because proper nouns are important when you're doing bad film writing.
Well, they also call them by their last names, too.
It was just, it's not good. It's not good, Dan.
Nobody called Bruce Dern Lieutenant.
No, but they kept calling him Rumsfeld. Sorry, not Rumsfeld. Different person with a crazy military thing. But then there is of course the number of times that they mention things that other characters are doing on screen that we see. It's just like you were describing actions that are occurring on film.
Are you talking about Corey Feldman?
Well, not just Corey Feldman, but like Bruce Dern, when he's like, oh, they're trying to decide who should ring the doorbell. It's like, of course, Bruce Dern, I can see that. Like we can all see that. We in the audience can see that. And now, yeah, while
still, this is totally suburbs. Like, you know, you peer out the window and see what your goofy neighbor is doing, and you go, she's playing the music again. It's still going. It's loud. The floodlight's on. There's. I mean, I may or may not be talking about my suburban neighborhood, but still, that's it's what you do. You comment. It's all in the tone.
Okay. Well, but see, here's the thing. It's a film. So they don't have to do that.
It's a reality as well.
Well, this is... Are you saying that this film approaches reality for you, Dan?
A little bit. Okay. It hits a little close to home with lightning and fire.
Ah, yeah. So, which neighbor's house did you blow up?
Nobody's yet.
Did you find their skulls?
No. It's if I had to guess, I wouldn't find skulls. I would just find, like, empty vodka bottles or something.
Okay, well then, would you say that there is a neighbor that you have a bone to pick with?
I would absolutely say that, but it would not be literal, and it would not be a pun.
How can you have a literal pun? That doesn't make any sense.
No, they are separate things.
Oh, Dan.
You are a pun, and the comment was literal.
How dare you? So
how dare you move into this neighborhood and disrupt the peace and quiet that we have?
Yes. Unlike Skip, who at least had the decency to live there first.
Skip had the decency to continue making milkshakes or whatever it was, ice cream down at the shop,
yeah,
that, even after he had horrifically murdered his family in his basement.
What was it, like lemon fizzy ices or something?
Something like that,
he
know.
Said something. I don't remember the exact line. It
made immaterial. One too many lemon fizzies or something,
yeah,
and then
yeah.
It snapped, of course.
Oh, dear.
And they play on Tom Hanks' gullibility so much that I love that Corey Feldman just, like, shouts at him and scares him.
Corey Feldman's an odd character in this, because
he's a kind of a ridiculous and terrible character in this too.
Well, no, but I thought that he would do things, like more than he does in the film, because you know it's Corey Feldman in the 80s. It was like, you know, the style of the time. Need I say? And no, I need not say that. But he was like a big to do, and it feels like they kind of gave him this role that was. Please just show up on our set, and then you'll say some things. And then you will leave our set, and then come back the next day, and we'll do it over again. And then, like, I didn't feel like
he's watching the Suburban Show, and he's having a party, because, you know, he's party dude. And he called the pizza dude. Pizza dude is a very big thing, apparently, for him.
Yeah, the pivotal pizza.
The pivotal pizza dude. And then, you know, he gets to make the big reveal at the end. I think that's probably how they sold him on the script, though.
Yeah, well, they were like, you're so important, Corey Feldman. Your career is only going to go up.
Tell you what, to sweeten the deal, we will throw in a leather jacket with more studs than any leather jacket has ever had in history.
Mm-hmm.
That thing that he was wearing is it probably weighed 30 pounds.
Oh, I saw it, Dan. I saw
yeah.
it.
Yeah, it's pretty spectacular.
Yeah,
do you think he brought that from home?
I don't know. I would assume somebody of his caliber doesn't need to bring his own clothes to the set.
No, I just mean like that's probably what he was just wearing that day, and he just like strolled in and they're like, yeah, that's fine. Have a seat.
Well, or he has one at home and they're like, oh, costume department, get us one of those. And so they got one. And so he has like one that he would wear to work, take off, and then put on another identical one and then act. And then take that one off, put on the other one, and go home.
He's got his day studded jacket, his night studded jacket.
Oh, yes. Well, you know, I don't.
Is his going out studded jacket like a little more polished and a little shinier?
Because he was a stud? Question mark. I don't know. Corey Feldman does nothing for me, but apparently people were all about it in their Tiger Beats or whatever. But the
he seemed like a chill dude.
Yeah, bro.
He had sunglasses and that hair.
Yeah.
He was painting his house.
Mm-hmm.
And hitting on Rumsfeld's wife.
No tan lines today.
I like Bruce Dern. He's such an old suburbanite. I said, that kid's a meatball. When did we stop calling people meatballs? I want to bring that back.
Oh, God, Dan. Are you the Bruce Dern in your neighborhood?
No, but directly across the street from my house, just like Tom Hanks, there is a man who has a flag flying on a pole in the middle of his yard every single day.
Wow.
So I think I'm the Tom Hanks of this movie.
Well, that is awfully aspirational of you. But
sure. Oh my God. Actually, if you think about the geography of the houses in this movie, there is a really weird guy to the right of my house where Art would be. Who I don't talk to very much, probably because he is very weird. To the other side of me is the person who would be the Klopex, who I was referring to earlier. And then directly across the street is the flag where Rumsfeld would live. That's apparently I am living in this movie, The Burbs, as well as the actual Burbs.
Are you? Wait, is not to triangulate, but are you on a cul-de-sac?
No. See, it's a well. There's one way, I guess. No, it's not technically a cul-de-sac. You come in, and there's a street that goes around in a circle, and then back out, but there's kind of, you know, an island of houses in the center. So it's just a circle and then exits.
So, wait, people have, like, pie-shaped lawns? How does that work? Like, how does that configuration work out?
So you go into the neighborhood. You can go right or left, but either way, you will circle back around to that same entrance.
But is it actually a circle?
It's a square.
Oh. So you go down and then you make a right, and then you go in a square around, and then you make a right, and you go back out the way you came.
Correct.
So that's an interesting thing.
It's the suburbs, man.
Yeah. It's an interesting development.
No.
I just wanted to let that hang there for a
just
second.
Let it linger in the air.
Dear. So
would you like to know who the developer was? You can call them and compliment them on their development layout.
I'll pass. But the I don't know who developed the neighborhood that Tom Hanks's character lives in the film.
That would be Universal.
Yeah, because well, what I was going to say is that it doesn't really seem to make a lot of sense as a neighborhood. Like with all of the modern houses and the one weird old house.
And yeah, and the way they refer to it, it was nice when the Knapps lived there, but then all of a sudden, like, these guys moved in and just stopped watering the lawn, and then everything died, and the house suddenly got covered in dirt inexplicably, and the paint started peeling. Like, they've been there a month, and suddenly their house looks like it was just dropped out of the sky from Kansas via a tornado or something.
Yeah, it makes no sense. I don't understand that embellishment. I mean, I could understand it if it's like, oh, those are the weird ones who always lived here, but that is not the path they chose for this, because then, of course, that wouldn't make any sense. Because the key point is that they moved in a month ago. So it's
just artistic suburban license, basically.
It would have made more sense if they had started with a house that was like everybody else's, and then they showed it like degrading over time, like weird things happening to it, like blacking out windows or painting certain things or putting tinfoil over things. Like,
well, you got the numbers falling off and knocking the light off and the bees coming out and all that fun stuff.
Yeah, but again, a month. So, I think that's weird.
And yeah, it is weird because, I mean, after 2 weeks, you'd get dinged by the HOA.
Well, if it was an actual development. I'm not even clear if it's a development.
Oh, it certainly, I mean, it certainly looks to my eye that they would have an HOA if that neighborhood was real.
Well, maybe it was like the old farmhouse that they built the development around.
Mm.
And they were the last holdouts, the Knapps. And then they took a nap. They took a dirt nap.
The suburban layout are terrible people, they use eminent domain to just take your house.
Dan, I have a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what they call a car's trunk in England?
A boot?
Yes. So would you say the Knapps got the boot?
I thought you were going to make a Canadian joke, but that's that one's better.
Yeah, well, everything's better than Canada. Sorry, Marco. I know you're not going to listen to this episode, Marco, so it's fine. I take back my apology.
We should say more things about people who aren't going to listen to this.
Yes, Casey Liss.
So I was just going to go there. Let's see, what can we say about Casey?
He has podcasts, and he says things on them, and we talk about him sometimes. And
if
then
Casey was in this movie, he would just be the one washing his BMW in the driveway, looking over, going, what are they doing over there?
Yeah, well, as long as you say he's not the person with the weird toupee and the dog, but
no. He's named Walter, like he's suddenly 70 years old?
No, well, in this past week's recording of Analog, Casey Liss compared himself to Tom Hanks, so maybe he would be Tom Hanks. So there's
like,
that.
Visually, what was the comparison?
In terms of casting for the Relay movie.
Oh, he was saying Tom Hanks would play him in the Relay movie?
Yeah.
Yeah,
that was my reaction too. I said maybe Colin Hanks, but but you know, whatever, as you do. You compared yourself to Tom Hanks like a hot second ago.
I mean, specifically geographically mm-hmm. in this one, mm-hmm. and the fact that I am beset on both sides by a weird guy and a psycho.
Yeah. Wait, how many times were you counting yourself when you were saying you were beset?
I don't count myself.
Oh.
I hear that's bad for you.
Mm. Count yourself too much and you go blind. But the... that really doesn't make any sense. So the point of this film? I don't know. So they start off.
And if you want to, like be an outsider and look at what these idiots are doing, basically, a new person moves into the neighborhood. They have never met them. They don't know them. They do very, very odd things that are very unsuburban like. And they begin to suspect that maybe there is some nefarious behavior going on because they're digging ditches in their backyard in the middle of the night, according to Tom Hanks' son. And then later he sees it himself. And then, you know, there's the loud noise and bright light coming out of the basement. And these are not suburban people. What are they doing in this neighborhood? It must be something bad because we are so bored. It has to be bad.
Yeah. But there are two twists to that.
It all goes downhill on a gurney.
Dear. So, like, I don't know. I think the first, like, 20 minutes of the film are actually pretty boring.
Suburbs.
Well, no, but you get the initial setup, which is sort of interesting, because you have the spooky neighbors and the wind. But then after that, you get into the sort of, like, you know, suburb stuff, and then it's the...
Their problems are small. Walter's dog keeps pooping on Bruce Dern's lawn, and he stepped in it, and he's very angry about that. Corey Feldman is just painting his house and staring at the neighbor's butt. Tom Hanks has taken a week off work because apparently he's got all kinds of anxiety problems and doesn't know how to relax. And Art's wife is out of town, so he's going to be a dingus and run around doing stupid things.
What you got to do is you have to have your breakfast, and then while you're having your breakfast, when you hear a gunshot, you got to go, Art's got a gun, because that's the conclusion everyone should jump to immediately, first thing.
Yeah, well, the suburbs are quiet enough to be able to discern the difference between gunshots and other loud noises.
Saying. You would know in Arizona.
People shoot at coyotes out here in the desert.
Oh, dear.
Art was shooting at a crow, like sort of in the direction of his neighbor's house, which is not a very bright idea.
Yeah, well, the crows didn't used to live here before they moved in, which doesn't really get a nice little bow put on that by the end of the film. put a crow on the mantle in the first act, nothing happens.
Is the crow on top of the furnace, or is the furnace next to the crow? Because that's the scale of this mantle has suddenly changed.
Well, I mean, it's a big mantle.
Yeah, but that furnace is hot.
It's the platonic mantle, Dan. It's as big as it needs to be.
Well, then how big is this house, I ask you?
It's as big as it needs to be. It is all-encompassing for the terms of story and cinema. It's the biggest mantle that you know, can God make a mantle so big even he can't sit on it? I don't know.
I mean, but what do they need a furnace that big for? This house isn't even that big, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, well, and especially Southern California. I mean, come on. It doesn't get that cold. So the things with the stuff and the weirdness, although, you know, it did rain an awful lot for California. Let's be honest.
Just like one day. Although, if this was actually California, they would probably get a letter from the EPA just from their carbon footprint or something.
Well, I mean, that is the 80s, Dan. You could like, this is right before, you know, Captain Planet and the Planeteers. You could still, like, burn garbage fires and stuff.
California was very progressive with that stuff. They sort of paved the way. Actually, you know, probably some of that early California legislation did come from the fact that there were weird families burning bodies in their basement in a 5,000-degree oven.
That's a pleasant thought. So
it's got its fair share of weirdos, too, is all I'm saying.
Well, duh. It's California, Dan. It's all hippies
like
and granola.
You live there.
But the...
Wait, no, that's Glenn's territory, hippies and granola.
Oh, yes. Well, Eugene, Oregon.
Yours is all just traffic and $6 coffee drinks.
Well, and juice bars, Dan. Don't forget the juice bars.
There is a juice bar very near to us that I have just recently discovered is there, but it smells like wheatgrass just from the parking lot, and I can't come anywhere near it.
Yeah. Well, you shouldn't, because wheatgrass is terrible, but you should get you should ask them if they have one of those strings with a garlic on it, like what Art wanted. But what's really weird is, like, on television commercials recently, they've started playing I didn't know hidden camera candid things where it's like the V8 guy, like, secretly gives them juice from the
commercials.
Truck. Yeah. And then there's the other guy who, like, secretly gives them the green juice from, I don't know, what was it? like Tropicana or something?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's what it was. It was Tropicana Farm Stand or some crap.
Yeah, it was like one's Tropicana and one's V8. And so the V8 one, like, whatever. But the Tropicana one, it's another thing where it's like, whatever, but at least, you know, the guy who's doing it is believably a complete actor and not qualified to actually make you juice, so I don't know why you would immediately assume that it was a real juice bar inside of whatever store you were in.
Are you suggesting that people who make juices have a particular look to them?
I might be making vast generalizations about the juice trade in Los Angeles.
The juice trade. So that's obviously where the East Indian Trading Company pivoted to, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
The
East Silver Lake Trading Company.
So, but, similar to the way you can tell a barista based on their hand and or neck tattoos and facial hair,
yes.
There is a look to juice bar employees?
Perhaps, Dan.
Hmm.
Perhaps.
Do you care to describe it at all? Or you would just leave it up to the imagination?
I'll leave it to the imagination. And then people can be like, I need to go to Los Angeles and go to a juice bar, a real juice bar, and then they'll go and do that. And although I recommend get the kale, date, and walnut or almond smoothie.
Now, is there like a Yelp for the real deal juice bar type places? Because we don't want them to end up at like the Cheesecake Factory of juice bars.
Yeah, no, real. The real deal. Yes.
No, I mean, like, how do they tell the difference between, you know, like a Chili's juice bar and like a real like Blue Bottle artisanal juice bar?
Well, one is a national chain called Chili's, and the other one is not.
Well, no, there's gotta be like a Chili's of juice bars. Like who is Big Juice Bar and who is the indie guy?
Oh, I guess you could say Clover is probably one of the bigger ones. Not Clover like the coffee thing that Starbucks bought, but Clover like something else, because you know, green things or whatever. The world. And then, but there are a few hippy dippy ones over in, Silver Lake and, down at, the Abbott Kenny's. So do that. Just go wherever there is pretension in Los Angeles. you're seeking peak pretension, by the way.
Okay.
Yeah.
Ours is called, I believe ours is called Nectar with a K.
Oh, we have those too. That's a big chain too.
Oh, is it a chain? Okay, yeah, good. Chain. So you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
So I should stay away from it then.
Well, I mean, it's juice, so yes, you should stay away from it, Dan. I don't think it's for you. I don't think they serve your kind there. you walk in the door, they'll be like, "We don't have like pureed waffles for you, Dan."
I have a beard. I would fit in with hipstery juice bar people.
Yeah, but you also walk in like, your sweatpants and flip flops.
I do not wear sweatpants or flip flops outside.
Okay.
I wear jeans everywhere.
What about the footwear situation, Dan?
Converse. Slip-on Converse always.
Oh, Dan.
It's my brand. How dare you?
Okay, well, I don't know. It's just, it's not very hipstery. It's what I'm getting at there.
Well, you know, also, literally yesterday, I was trying to remember when I bought this pair of jeans that I mostly wear most of the time, and I looked down and I'm like, oh yeah, it has the very, very easy to identify indentation of an iPhone on the left pocket, and it has both the iPhone 5S sized dent as well as the 6 and 6S sized dent. So I've at least had it for 2.5 cell phone versions, so that's how old my jeans are.
That's how you should count everything, Dan.
Apparently, like based on the indelible mark that my phone has left on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we were talking about a movie at some point.
Sure. The Burbs. I mean, look, honestly, the problems of indelible cell phone marks on jeans are about as real as the problems as these suburbanites had in their movie here. So there, that's how I brought it around for you.
Yeah, but could you call the power company or the police department on your cell phone? Spoiler, you can. But Bruce Stern has that radio he's awfully proud of.
Oh yeah, it's got siren mode. Siren mode.
Yeah. Can we talk about Bruce Stern for a second?
Yes. I think he is perfect for this movie.
I was initially very put out by the lines he was delivering at the start of the film, But then once he got past the exposition that was required of him, I felt like he improved. Because he turns out to be an excellent man-child with some slight amount of army trauma or something.
I mean, speaking of the man-child, like the moment where Carrie Fisher takes over and becomes the mom of Tom Hanks and says, you know, Ray can't come out to play, and they sort of like shove their hands in their pockets and kind of like kick a pebble across the road and look down all sad like five-year-olds. That's A-plus filmmaking right there.
Oh, I love that. But my favorite Bruce Dern shot in the film is when he is sitting on top of the roof, and it's the wide-angle shot of the like hills and stuff in the background behind him, and he's got his little yellow mug and the animal crackers, and he's eating them in his in his army fatigues.
Yeah. He's sitting on his roof with very high-powered binoculars, eating animal crackers, drinking coffee.
It's a good look for him, is all I'm saying.
Yeah.
But what's also interesting is like he's so negative towards Corey Feldman and so angry at them for not I don't know, structure and lives and whatever. But one of the things that he's most known for is the main character in Silent Running, where he's a hippie that like takes over a spaceship and then, you know, goes off into space with the garden. It's weird. Don't watch it. It's not good. And so
but I'll put that in my queue with Zardoz.
Yeah. Well, what was it? Robert Abel, I think, directed it, and he, you know, he's a big VFX guy from the 60s, 70s, 80s. But like the, so that's why I watched it. But pass. So the movie, we get past all of the introduction stuff and then all of the paranoia bubbles, and we're supposed to believe that the paranoia is bubbling in such a way that the actions that they perform will seem logical later.
I don't know that it's necessarily logical. It's a combination of the fact that their lives are so mundane that anything different sticks out so much that it absolutely positively must be nefarious.
I suppose. Although I do have to ask, like, what is he on a vacation from? And what is he on a vacation from that his second home by a lake is too much trouble to go to? I don't know. I have a hard time relating to his character. Because, you know, here I am working 10-hour days, several days a week, and then here's this guy, la-di-da-da-da, can't be bothered to go to my lake house. I'll just stay at home because that's just too much work for me. And I was just like, geez, I just... great for you. Like, what do you do for a living? We never know. But that's probably for the best.
Again, having grown up here and having worked a boring corporate job, I knew people who had a cabin up in Flagstaff. Like, they either built or bought a tiny cabin, and their hobby would be going up there on the weekends and just working on it or just hanging out in it or something. But mostly they went up there and worked on it because it's a never-ending project. That's just like what that's what they do with their free time.
Yeah, I know, but I have an apartment. I don't have two homes, is what I'm saying.
It's not so much it's a cottage, okay?
Yeah.
It's a cottage on a lake. You know, it was a different time. Mm-hmm. The economy was probably a little bit, it was a little more optimistic at least.
Yeah, well, it was the 80s. Thanks, Reagan. But, so...
It's all his fault. This entire movie is Reagan's fault.
Well, I mean, technically, it would have been Bush when this movie came out, the first one, but it was the policies of Reagan from the years before, because that's not really, you know, the economy, it's like a carryover thing. Like,
it takes a while to actually have an effect.
Yeah. So
it's trickle-down Tom Hanks.
Yeah.
Sorry. Trickle-down lake cottages? Is that better?
No,
I don't know how to describe it better.
I don't know if better is the right word, but
which one sounds less inappropriate? I should have asked.
I'm glad you asked. Moving on.
We spit my water. Don't do that.
Okay. Don't spill your water. So the whole thing here with the tension between him and Carrie Fisher is established, and we get the whole obsessiveness and weird ex-army militariness of Bruce Dern and his I don't know how they met wife of Wendy Shaw, and we also get the introduction of Queenie the dog and their wonderful neighbor that they love so much, who couldn't confide in any of them and instead asked the weirdos to get his mail.
I think it was probably his sister or whatever who took him to the hospital that asked the neighbor.
Oh, yeah, maybe.
I mean, it was just whoever was closest.
Yeah, she was like, that house looks friendly.
Although, to be honest, he's not friends with anyone on the block, so she could have picked anyone. It would make no difference to Walter,
I suppose. And so and we also establish Art, who is a buffoon, and just like will keep eating everything in your house. Mm-hmm. And we establish that the Kulpex live there and that they are weird and nobody has seen them except at night, which is a fact conveyed to us by the kid, who in one of his rare lines mentions this and then disappears for a long time.
Hans Kulpex.
Yes,
I love his little his Pinocchio outfit at the end there.
Well,
Lederhosen and hat.
It's exactly what Bruce Dern calls him.
Yeah, I know.
The important takeaway from this film is that xenophobia is totally justified.
Is that a Slovak name?
No.
No.
Yeah. It's weird. And so we get a lot of like tension about the anxiety surrounding the Kulpex without actually much to do with the Kulpex. And we get a lot of tension between Tom Hanks and his wife. And we get a lot of tension between the neighbors all trying to decide what to do about the Kulpex. And it's kind of boring. And then they get to the part where things start happening. In that the Kulpex drive their car down to the end of the driveway and put the suspicious bag in it. And he beats the bag and it's in the rain and everything's really creepy. And he gets back in his car and he goes back into the house. And
there's totally like red, presumably fake blood dripping down the side of that trash can when they do that scene too.
Yeah, it's odd. And then the... We really bizarro thing about that, and then there's the digging in the backyard stuff, and they're like, oh, we can't go digging through his trash at night, we have to do it in broad daylight. And it's like, that wouldn't necessarily make it less creepy. There's not really a good time to do that. And then we get the garbage truck scene, which is odd. And then the denial about oh, there must be a dead body in here somewhere. And it's like, so obviously we're off to the wrong start here with the way you might go about doing this in such a way as to not draw suspicion to yourself.
They're incredibly inept detectives, but they're playing spy because it's their neighborhood, damn it.
Yeah, well, what I really like is that they leave the garbage there for the rest of the film.
in the middle of the road that everyone keeps driving over. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a nice callback that you can establish some you can establish some sense of environment to the fact that nobody cleaned that. And that, as someone who makes a film or film-like things or whatever, that someone was in charge of the continuity of that trash pile.
Sure.
Yeah, so...
Every day somebody showed up and laid out that trash and made sure it looked right, and then some cars drove over it and they cleaned it up at the end of the day.
Yeah. And then they put it back out again the same day. So it was, it was good stuff. Then... we get the weird scene where Tom Hanks and his buddy or Art are talking about how it's obviously about Satanism, which...
Well, don't they find the bone before that?
Oh, yeah, the femur. The dog fetches the femur and comes back, and then Tom Hanks doesn't know what a femur is, and one of the most unbelievable exchanges of dialogue in the film.
Well, they didn't have Wikipedia in 1989, so...
Yeah, you had to rely on your complete buffoon neighbor Art to explain to you what a femur was. So it's biology 101. So they have that, and then they have the Satanism scene, and then they're sitting there watching bedtime horror slasher films or something, which is just a weird bedtime pastime for Tom Hanks and Carrie Fisher, but it's what they're doing. And so they watch their things with the sacrifice and the chainsaw and whatever that other thing was that they cut to briefly.
It was The Exorcist and The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And I can't remember what the first one was.
Yeah, I don't know what that one was, but then
human sacrifice.
Yeah, then they smushed them all together for the big dream sequence.
I love that even in the dream sequence, it's still very suburban in that he's tied to like a giant Weber grill.
Also, I like that the dream sequence feels like they spent maybe $200-$250 on it.
There's at least $200 in, you know, fog and dry ice alone in that, so maybe a little bit more.
Okay, well, I mean,
how many cloaks did they have to buy? There were like 12 cloaks.
Anyway, it's chintzy, is what I'm getting at. It does not feel like high production quality dream sequence, is all I'm saying.
High production quality dream sequence. What is the highest production quality dream sequence that you could reference?
The beginning of First Contact when Picard...
I'm sorry I asked.
Okay, well, I don't want to spoil it for you. But so anyway, it's a good dream sequence. They spent a lot of money on it, Dan. It had a matte painting. But
this one had a chainsaw cutting through a wall.
You can get a chainsaw at Walmart for like $40.
No, this was a legitimate lumberjack-style chainsaw. It had the very long blade. It was the steel? I don't know how to pronounce the STIHL brand. And that's what they really use for cutting down trees and or Texas Chainsaw Massacring.
Ah, well, everything's massacred in Texas. I don't know how that saying goes. But it's not a good movie. Actually, odd that you bring that up, because and odd that we watched this movie, which also brought it up from the 80s, which is amazing. But this past week, I also watched the third episode of Scream Queens, which is actually the second episode, because the pilot was really the first two episodes pushed together, but whatever. But in the third episode, there was a lot of chainsaw stuff. And for some reason, one of the main characters is like, let's watch this for film history class, and we'll watch the best movie ever, Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And I just have to register here on the record that... The movie Texas Chainsaw Massacre is horrible. It is a terrible movie.
Which one? Because it's been remade like three times.
Here's the thing. The first one, the Tobe Hooper original, was the one that they put up on that thing, and they were just like, oh, this is the most amazing thing ever. That is horrible. I can't stand it. Here's the weird twist to that statement. I watched the Jessica Biel one. I can make it through the whole way through that film. I don't need to ever see it again. But it didn't make me want to like claw my ears out because there's just a woman screaming for 15 minutes.
That's the one with that guy with the almond-shaped head and the weird chin hair, isn't it?
I'm not sure.
He's the lead guy. He was big in the 90s, early 2000s.
Ah, well.
Good. Yeah, no, I saw that one too. I don't ever need to see it again either.
Yeah, I mean, I don't need to see it again either, but... one of the weird things is everybody's like, oh, this is ruining a classic. And then so I watched the classic afterwards, and I was just like, this is terrible. I don't care that you ruined this classic. It's fine.
there is yet another newer one, right, that they kind of rebooted with Unknowns, isn't it?
Oh, I have no idea.
Yeah. There's a reboot after the Jessica Biel one, I think.
Oh, I thought that it was just a sequel after the Jessica Biel one.
No, I think it's a reboot. Right, who cares? Well, they're all terrible. But anyway.
It doesn't really matter. It's stupid. And nobody should hold it up as an example of high cinema.
Terrible chainsaw dream sequence references.
Also, especially if you have a slasher going around in your neighborhood, don't watch slasher movies and stuff in horror movies in your film history class. Maybe be a little more sensitive to other people's feelings and pick something else to watch. That's all I'm saying about Scream Queens. But so moving on. So that was a weird dream sequence, and Carrie Fisher's at the top of the staircase, and she's like, and the dress, and there's fog and stuff. And then Art is Skip, and he's like, don't worry, I'm not Skip, I'm just dressed like Skip. And it's just like, okay, Art.
He's got the milkshake maker in his hand. And...
Yeah, it's very strange. And then, Brother Theodore is there with the knife and stuff. And so...
Don't forget Walter popping out of the trash can. With the the axe stuck in his head, and then the little tinier axe stuck in the dog's head.
Don't let it happen to you, what they did to me. And it's terrible.
It's great.
It's so cheesy and terrible. And so, anyway, the end of the dream sequence, he wakes up and he has his, like, what is orange juice just next to his bed. And then he goes...
taking the smallest sips of orange juice ever.
Yeah, and he sits on the, little rooftop deck thing there, and then that's when the guys come over to see him, and like you're saying, Carrie Fisher sends them away. Like, in a very maternal fashion. You guys can't talk to him until he's the man that I married or whatever. Strange, clunky line. And so then they have whatever sequence it was that makes Carrie Fisher go, oh, we should go over and talk to them. We should just, like, do what we should have done, like, 5,000 years ago and go talk to them.
Well, Bruce Dern and Art come up with the spectacular idea of ringing the doorbell and sticking the note under the door that just says, I know what you did, because, you know, you got to goose them to get them off balance so they make a mistake and you can catch them.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And then they go over and Art says this to Tom Hanks, and Tom Hanks flips out and he says, oh, why Ressa Frassen, why you oughta, you know, it's one of those things where it's just like, can someone have written some, like, lines of frustration for Tom Hanks to have expressed here instead of just, like...
No, they just said, just give us a full Tom Hanks and just go for it.
Yeah, just talk like Yosemite Sam for a couple seconds and it'll be fine. Nobody will know. And so he just like, why oughta you, and so... Just,
they're gonna think he did it because he wrote a note and stuck it into Walter's little mail slot, and they saw him do that. Now there's another unlabeled note that goes in there.
Yeah, and then there's the little balled up piece of paper. It's like, oh, what's that? Oh, it's my note. It's just,
yeah,
it's nothing.
Yeah, it's my note.
Dear. Then we get the whole So this is the part where Carrie Fisher suggests that they all go across and just talk to them like normal, rational people, like they ought to. And so it's...
We'll probably find out more in 5 minutes than you could all this, you know, these past 2 days just snooping around.
Yeah, well, she's right. And because they do technically, by quantity, find out more information. They're like, she's like, no, an art can't come. Because that makes a lot of sense, really. Because she's smart enough to know... Art should not be around people. Unfortunately, though, she seems to like Bruce Dern's girlfriend or wife. I can't remember. Played by Wendy Shaw, enough to invite her and Bruce Dern along, although she probably should have left Bruce Dern out of the equation as well, because basically everything he does is horrible.
He's a bit harsh.
Yeah, I mean, he is standing on the porch and breaks through it, because obviously a month without porch maintenance makes for a brittle floorboards. Then,
I mean, you got to make sure you get that extra, you know, that Thompson's water seal on there at least, you know, twice a month.
Oh yeah. Polyurethane thing, like 2-3 times a day. Really? I mean, you got to make sure.
It's not just pride and ownership. It also makes it last longer. And that is important for the foundation of a home.
Yes. Well, Home is where the furnace is.
In this particular instance, you would be correct.
Yes. Yes. Well, I was going to say hearth, but I don't think we actually saw a hearth in the film. So, But you wouldn't really need one in Southern California. But anyway, not to say that you can't have a hearth. I'm not trying to be hearth normative. But they go in and things are awkward. And
Hans knocks off the little picture off the shelf, and then Bruce Dern grills him on who the pretty girl is, and he says it came with the frame, which I think is hilarious.
Yes, it's a good line. And then Bruce Dern peels their wallpaper.
He tries to put it back casually.
Yeah,
because he's looking under the wallpaper to see if there's something hidden back there, of all places.
Yeah, well, that's normally where I hide things, behind wallpaper. And he's, like, knocking on the walls. He's like, ah, solid walls you got here. And then, you know, oh, you should see your basement unless you got something to hide.
Well, he stomps on the floor, and then somebody replies back with the same number of taps from the basement, which I guess that's just what you do. If somebody knocks on your ceiling with a particular set of knocks, you reply back with the same knocks, right? Isn't that how it works?
Yeah, and if they shout down echo, you shout back up echo.
is that what you do with your neighbors?
This is totally what you do. It's neighbor etiquette. There's the whole thing with the uncle who has. I mean, talk about resting grumpy face. He has some resting grumpy face, Tom Hanks has served the infamous Foley sardines and the pretzel.
Infamous Foley sardines.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a lot of sound went into that.
You think they just like put a broom handle in a bucket of Crisco and just stirred it around to get that sound?
I don't know. We should find out who did the Foley on this and ask them. Mm. Should be our real homework that we do for this to make this a legitimate pot. I've already given up.
I hope I'm looking right now. I hope they separated it out specifically and just they gave specific credit to the Foley artist who did just the sardines.
Well, when the furnace putters out from outside, it makes kind of a Millennium Falcon stalling out noise.
Absolutely. It's the exact same sound.
Yeah. And so, because you're such an expert, Dan.
I am. Now that you've shamed me, I know what the damn sound was. I was tired.
Yeah, well, the important thing is you learned from your shame.
I learned not to say things, apparently.
Not to say things because we're at an hour and 14 minutes into this phone conversation.
Well, this is it's just a casual phone conversation that's being broadcasted publicly. Anyway, yeah. We have two credited Foley artists on this film, Dan O'Connell and Foley artist Kevin Bartnoff. So there's plenty of other people in the sound department, but those are the only two credited as Foley artists.
Okay. I'm sure one of them kind of know.
There's special sound effects. Maybe that's Millennium Falcon / Sardine Man.
Did they have a Ben Burt listed anywhere in there?
I do not see a Ben Burt. Mm. That man's name is John Pospisil. Pospisil? I don't know how to pronounce it. Pospisil.
Great.
John Pospisil. Pospisil.
Okay, we're moving on. Can we possibly move on? So the
he eats the sardine and then the pretzel. He goes into some sort of sneezy coffee Tom Hanks allergy fit.
Oh, got somebody tied up in the old cellar, have you, Rude?
That's not really how allergies work, but sure.
You know, it's packing dust. He blows his nose into some newspaper.
Yeah. Which was strange that there was just a ball of newspaper there. It didn't really seem like
they haven't unpacked yet.
Well, it seemed like they had unpacked an awful lot of things. Because there was all of their weird old stuff was there. Unless that came with the house, because the previous owners didn't need it. And so
they didn't take any of their stuff with them.
Yes. Well, the brother, the doctor, came upstairs, and he gets a very dramatic introduction with the light behind him and the tiny silhouette, and the door closes, and he comes around the corner, and it's Henry Gibson, famous character actor from all of those things you've already seen, and he's doing like his best Peter Lorre for this film. Mm-hmm. Which is interesting. Or Peter Lorre?
It's Lorre.
It's Lorre. Okay. I wasn't sure. So it's not Peter Mem.
No, it's not Peter Mem. In America, they call him Peter Truck. But yes, his name is Peter Lorre.
Oh, God. Our podcast is so dumb. So the thing with the stuff... the burbs. And so the aristocrats. And so he introduces himself and they have their little conversation, which is weird, and nobody asks a doctor of what. Nobody seems to care. They're just like, oh, it's great to have a doctor in the neighborhood. They have their conversation for what seems like hours, since it was like about midday, but judging by the daylight when they walked inside of the house, and it is nighttime by the time Art manages to walk from the edge of the fence to the basement. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you were paying attention to the passage of the daylight outside of the building, but
yes,
it was interesting. That was some X-Men 3 level, like, let's just skip a couple hours kind of thing.
Well, it wasn't necessarily morning time when they went over there, because he had already taken his nap, and they found the femur, and they got the note, and that was all the same day.
Yes.
And that's a big day. That's a full suburban day, I'm not going to lie. You get the nap, You got the femur. You got the talking to the friend. You got the orange juice. Like, what else are you going to need to do that day?
I don't know. Have some fiber?
Hmm. Well.
Working your 401k. So...
See, this was the 80s. They were only back on the 400 Ks.
All the Ks. So they have the thing with the stuff where they have the awkward goodbye because Tom Hanks has coffee on his lap and goes to the bathroom, but it's not the bathroom, and then Marmaduke escapes. And then Marmaduke busts through the screen porch and goes after Art. And
keep a horse in the basement?
Art causes a problem because there's an alarm with some fog lights and some electrical stuff.
Fog lights. They've got like 30 lights all around just that one wall of their house just that light up as soon as anyone trips over that wire on the fence.
Yeah. Speaking of missing daylight, it's back again. So
That would have been... suspicious thing number one, if these people moved in and put a tripwire along their fence that set off lights like that, right then and there, I'm calling the FBI.
Well, see something, say something. So...
And you would see it very clearly with that much damn light, is what I'm saying.
Okay. Is there something you want to reveal about your neighbors who have those lights across the way from you? Do they have tripwires?
All I'm saying is the floodlight is on 24 hours a day. In the daytime, at nighttime, when I know they are sleeping and they are still playing the music and the floodlight is on, like, what is the deal? Like, is it just like you get drunk and black out and leave the Maroon 5 and the floodlights going? Like, what is the deal?
Maroon 5?
There's like a Spotify playlist of like four songs, three of which are Maroon 5 songs that are just on loop all freaking day long.
Okay, how much Imagine Dragons is there?
Oh, my God. Okay, so there is... When I was cutting the lawn this past weekend, there was a Rihanna song and a Maroon 5 song. Only two songs on loop the entire time I was in the backyard for 2 hours.
I have to agree with you for a second here. No matter what the song is, there is nothing, absolutely nothing more annoying than someone playing any song on loop. Just, it's the worst. Like, in an office setting, like, anywhere. Like, it drives me up a wall. It's just like, can you move on? Like, I don't like whatever this is, but the fact that I'm hearing it over and over and over and over again, it's just, like, really grating on me. And even if you do like whatever it is, by the time you're done listening to it over and over and over again, you don't like it anymore.
Yeah,
it's the magic of repetitiveness. I have to agree with you. So anyway, the lights go on, Art's caught. They excuse themselves because it was such a pleasant evening. And then they have a little meeting back over at Tom Hanks' house, and Tom Hanks pulls a quick one on the audience and Carrie Fisher by saying, "Oh, I agree with all of you that they're totally normal people." And we're all going, "Oh, Tom Hanks, what? No way.
He's very calm. He's very calm. He's turned a corner. He's relaxed. He has let the anxiety go, but the reason is because he found evidence.
Yes.
Walter's toupee that he stuck through the mail slot back of Walter's house after they were done breaking in was found in the bathroom at the Klopex. And the only way that is possible is if they went back into the house where they went the first time to kidnap and murder and, I don't know, what, like eat Walter or something? And I'm not entirely sure why.
Okay, wait. Dan.
Hmm.
They did not eat any of the victims in this film. Let's not go too far with this, okay?
All right. Well, do we know for sure? Do we honestly know?
It was not expressly conveyed to the audience that
any of them
were
eating. They have peculiar eating habits, is all I'm saying. Sardines and pretzels, like, that's not a sufficient diet. You're going to need to get your protein somewhere.
But if you're going to, like, shoot someone up with poison to kill them, would you really eat them?
No, in that instance, I think that was just more of a revenge killing, specifically because he blew up their house. Well, not even their house. Like, I don't know why he's that mad. Like, it's not like he was paying the mortgage or anything.
Well, okay, we're skipping ahead to the end where there's the double twist.
The double twist.
Yeah.
So they go so far. Well, I guess we won't skip over this. So yes, Tom Hanks pulls the fast one. He found the toupee, and that means he's going to send his wife away tomorrow because, he turned a corner, and he's convinced her. He's a very good actor, this Tom Hanks, and he pretended to be back to normal. But he sends her away for the day to go hang out with, I don't know, her friend Sheila or whatever the hell he said.
And, no, it was, I thought it was like her sister or cousin or aunt or something.
Something like that.
You know, yeah, because the kid's complaining because he's like, oh, I don't like my cousins. They're terrible. One of them is mean and the other one smells. And it's just like, okay, great. I'm glad you have four lines in this film. Goodbye, child no one cares about. Yeah, but so then they we have a series of costume changes for Art where he's
wearing his golf outfit. Yeah, because he's really got to sell the lie that they're going to go golfing that day.
Yeah, and then he has his electrical power company outfit for working on the electrical pole in the back.
I mean, if somebody sees him climbing up that pole, he better be wearing the appropriate attire.
Yes, because nothing will be suspicious about it.
Actually, I wonder if he
clothes.
Saved his outfit from Die Hard, where he was the guy in the manhole who shut down the power grid. Basically the same outfit and same job.
Yeah, basically. But so anyway, what was funny about this to me is that after he has changed into golf clothes, out of golf clothes, into this full electrical company worker outfit, then he gets onto the electrical pole and he starts climbing up and he says, time's a-wastin'. And I'm like, you've had two costume changes. You do not get to say everyone's wasting time. That's not how that
it's
works.
It's not a waste of time. It's fashion, okay? You got to make time for fashion.
Yeah, well, you got to make time for style.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's very important. You know, you got to dress for the job you want.
Dan. You've got to make time for style.
Oh, my God.
You just got it. Yes! I win! I've crushed you!
I hate you so much as I type that into the show bots. Got to make time. No, hang on. For style. Got to make sure we get that captured properly. I take it back. You are no longer my favorite co-host of this show.
Who have I been supplanted by?
I don't know.
am I supplanted by yourself?
Sure. Yeah. No, I don't count.
Are we in a cul-de-sac of co-hosts?
Yeah. The cul-de-sac of. Oops, I missed an L.
You don't have to type these, by the way. Other people typed them for us.
Yeah. Well.
You spelled cul-de-sac.
Whoops.
Cul-de-sac. So, with a K.
It's very warm in here. You know, yeah. I'm going to leave it like that. We're going to make the title that, and I'm going to leave it that spelling.
You said it. Now that we have to do it, it's etched in stone.
No, not at all. So, after his beautiful electric company outfit is sadly fried by the electricity. He changes his clothes again, and they finally go over the fence and do some digging. They dig a great many holes in the backyard, and they find nothing.
Okay. So first of all, that was stupid. Because if you're trying to stealthily do anything, digging is not stealthy in any way, because mostly it leaves evidence that you dug something in someone's backyard there, because there will be dirt that has moved.
The way we figured there were already so many holes in Fourth Avenue, nobody would even notice. See what I'm saying? Yeah. It's Murray logic.
Yes. Only he's not in the movie. Could you imagine this movie with Bill Murray instead of Tom Hanks and Dan Aykroyd instead of Art?
I would need a few minutes to actually imagine that, but I think I would very much enjoy imagining that.
Mm-hmm.
Who would we have Ramus be Bruce Stern?
Yes, of course.
Oh, God damn it. I want to make this movie now.
You can't. They're dead.
I know, but I want to.
Okay.
Damn
well,
it.
I mean, they. Only one of them, technically. Mm. But so anyway, the other one is vodka. So the stuff.
I thought it was a tequila.
No, Crystal Skull vodka, Dan.
Oh, God. Oh, that's right. It's the stupid.
All right. So they are. They're like, hey, digging holes isn't getting us anywhere.
Let's go dig another hole inside.
Yeah, they're like, let's go into the basement. And they're like, okay, give me your credit card. I like this, because this keeps us up with continuity, because he takes out his credit cards and they're all melted together.
I like that part.
I really like that. I like that attention to detail, because that is a joke that delivers on itself visually. without them necessarily having to do any of the stuff earlier in the film where they were explaining what things were happening on screen. Like, he didn't say, like, oh, my cards are melted together, because that would have ruined the moment. And so then Tom Hanks takes, in frustration, takes out his own credit card, and then he tries to use it to open the door, and Art is asking, where did you learn how to do that? And then, of course, Tom Hanks breaks it, because he obviously doesn't know how to do that. And it's not that kind of door. And so he...
they don't make doors like that anymore. You can't pick a door with a credit card.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you couldn't pick this door with a credit card either, because it was from before the time that you could pick doors with credit cards.
Yeah, it was before the style of the time.
Yes. It was the middle of the style of the time where you sure. could do this. I like Art's line. It was a stupid story anyways. But then they just leave the card there, and it's just like, again... You guys, with your stealth,
he probably picked something that was just kind of like a loyalty card or something. It probably didn't have his name on it.
Well, they didn't have loyalty cards back then. It would have been like a department store card.
Are you saying loyalty was invented in the 2000s?
No, loyalty was invented in the 90s, Dan. Everybody knows that. Mm-hmm. You didn't work at a grocery store, Dan. you don't know the cash and carry preferred customer program.
Tell me about it. Is there a fee? Is there a yearly fee?
No, there's no yearly fee. It's free
to
sign up.
How about that?
Just fill out this form. And then
would they potentially mail me coupons and information to keep me informed on sales?
I think you mean special deals, Dan.
Special deals. Special for me specifically?
Just for you.
So if I don't sign up now, I'm going to miss out on deals. Let's be clear about this, right?
Yes, and the savings, Dan. Think of all the savings in the store.
Does it perchance build up over time? Like the more time I spend shopping at the store, the more sales I am prone to?
Oh, no. The kind that accrued points occurred later in the 2000s. Mm.
Yeah. See, the accrued points, that really revitalized the loyalty industry.
Yeah, what really did it was the coupons tied to your customer card that printed out from CVS in like those 5-foot-long strips. That's what really sealed the deal.
I still get those every time we go to the Safeway.
Yeah, they're like, hey, here's $2 off on that thing you don't need or you just bought.
Half the time it's for cat food because we share an account with Amanda's parents.
Oh, they have cats?
Yeah.
How many cats?
Two? Three. They have three right now. One's very old and two are like young, like brother, sister.
Okay. I was going to ask why that was such a difficult question for you to
answer.
Do a lot of cats come in and out of there a lot?
They have free reign of the backyard from time to time because they do go outside, and their house is very near to the Indian reservation again, and coyotes. So, yeah.
Oh.
Coyotes can, will, and often do grab animals out of backyards and take them back over the wall, and you never see them again.
Well, that was cheerful.
Yeah.
So, let's go back to the movie now that you have... shown that little bright beam of sunlight into our lives. And so at nighttime, Corey Feldman is still getting people to come over to check out stuff and bother Bruce Stern. And downstairs in the basement, Tom Hanks and Art are poking around with the furnace, and they're like, oh, you think it should go to 5,000? This is unusual. This tube looks new. And then one of the weirder things is they're like, let's just turn it on.
I think this button turns it on and shoots a 6-foot flame out of the door.
Yeah, well, that must have been a hectic day on set for the insurance guy. But so the...
It's all movie fire. It's not as hot as it looks like.
It's all movie fire. So the flames come out. And then go back in, and the light comes out, and there's smoke and noise, and everybody can hear it outside, and the gun on tripod that Bruce Stern has starts sliding down, and so he has to go get it, and then he goes to get it, and then Corey Feldman calls his name, and then he freaks out and falls down, well, the stuntman falls down, and then lands on the ground, and then Bruce Stern is like, ah, why are you shooting that? And so,
he accidentally shoots out the window of his Corvette as well, don't forget
that. Oh, yeah, and then the other friends are with the feathered hair are like, wow, because they're so impressed that something actually
happened.
Party's
starting to get cool, man.
Yeah, weird party. So then they have, the whole thing with the furnace, and they're like, okay, so that means maybe they cremated the body, which is in this pile of ashes, which might be covering this dirt, which might be covering something else. Ah, I'm going to go get it. And then...
And don't forget, meanwhile, while the furnace was doing its loud, bright thing, the Klopex came around the corner and they saw somebody was in their basement.
Ah, yes, yes, yes. And then they turned off their headlights and got out of the street.
And turned backwards in their incredibly loud, smoky Buick or whatever that apparently nobody noticed.
Yeah, yeah. That's the thing that I really like. You have a bunch of teenagers who are specifically there to watch for something happening. Don't see a thing. You have Bruce Dern on top of the house, who's there to see and be the lookout to communicate when something happens. Doesn't see a thing. And so then,
it's a very loud furnace. But I gotta say, this is the one instance where we veer off the rails, and this is very not suburban. I'm just gonna say, I can hear cars from two blocks away while I'm like in the bedroom of my house. I don't even have to be outside, and I can hear a car approaching.
Humble brag. So
it's so quiet in my neighborhood that I can literally hear cars driving around.
Oh, look at you. Lap of luxury.
We don't have that constant drone of cars 24 hours a day that you eventually learn to tune out like California.
Well, it's not so much a constant drone of cars as it is like, a stream of cars that's at a sort of pattern like pace, and then all of a sudden every now and then fire engine or motorcycle or really loud car with rap music blasting out of it, and you're just like, this is different. But most of the time it's just that generic white noise of crappy cars. And so anyway, nobody notices the car, and they back out of there slowly on their tippy toes, and then the Art comes upstairs, and it's like, oh man, this is crazy. And Tom Hanks is digging and digging, and he's like, I hit metal, this is the important part. And it's the gas line, and the cops come back, and
don't forget, Walter rolls up all at the same time, and he gets out of his car, and it's a very dramatic reveal that, holy crap, the thing you're digging for is not Walter, because Walter is still alive. He is here, and he's got a walker, so clearly he was in the hospital, and that's why he left so quickly.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes.
And if you didn't put that together through the visual cues of what is going on, they literally say that later when the detective explains things to Art.
Yes. That detective had a very important role of saying things that the audience couldn't connect by themselves.
He also got to say, is this your car, Mr. Klopik?
Yes.
Yeah. So that's, you know. That's the cherry on the detective sundae there.
Yeah, it's what every detective actor yearns for, is that cherry. So they have the thing with the stuff and the things, and so the house blows up. Art got out of there just in the nick of time, but Tom Hanks didn't, and then he comes out of the rubble. With makeup prosthesis covering half of his face and some tattered jeans.
I mean, his eyes swole shut very quickly.
Yeah, that's totally how swelling works, and explosions and surviving fires. So, because, I mean, it just shreds your clothes. Your skin's fine. And then
well, it was the sheer the speed and the velocity of the explosion.
Yes. Again, that's not really how that works, but sure. And so he comes out of there in his Joe Dante cartoon-like Wile E. Coyote-ness and stumbles out there. And we're all feeling terrible for the Klopex, because here they are getting the police to come to their house to arrest these people who have broken into their home, because they know there's nothing suspicious inside of their home. Do you know why they know that?
Because it's in their car.
Yes, because we've already said that earlier in the podcast. But so the
although I do like that, like when they see that their house is on fire and blew up, that they actually have like the sad look on their face, like somebody who was actually, you know, in the right, and oh no, somebody actually blew up our house, and poor us.
Well, I mean, it is poor them, because not, I mean, the serial killers are not. That's just terrible news. You know, houses are expensive, Dan. They don't just grow on trees. And
I mean, they're not expensive if you just kill the people living in them and then just start living there.
Yeah, well, see, this is the double twist. Because we get the twist that they weren't really, you know, evil and nefarious people doing bad things. That he really was a doctor and he was a well-respected pathologist. And as explained by Exposition Cop. And so and Tom Hanks is feeling terrible and he's angry at art and he's like, you talked me into all of this, which is not really how that works because this was Tom Hanks' plan. And so
he got carried away, but it was mostly art's doing.
Well, I mean, art egged him on to do it, but Tom Hanks literally laid out the plan for what they were going to do to deceive his wife and then break into this house. So, I mean, it's not like Tom Hanks was like, just along for the ride, because he had the plan. So anyway, they have this confrontation. He's like, oh, just get me out of here. I want to go. Take me to the hospital. And then Carrie Fisher's like, yeah, I'll find out where they're sending. I'll just meet you there or something.
He throws another Hanks tantrum.
Yeah, and so he's inside the ambulance, and then Dr. Klopek comes in, and again, best Peter Lorre impersonation, where he's like, yes, my house, but I gave you the femur and you could keep it, but you took the skull because now the house has exploded or something. I don't know how that works, because where did he have the skull?
You know.
Anyway, so...
It was probably in the first... You know, it's probably what they accidentally burned when they turned it on, but, you know, you saw the skull. You're lying to them, but I know as soon as they take this ambulance away, you're going to rat on me because you actually saw my skull. And it's not actually the case, and what Dr. Klopek actually just did was confess, which is not a terribly bright thing to do.
Yeah. And then he tries to poison him with a syringe, and there's a struggle, and then Pinocchio's driving the car into Art's house, and...
Hanks is grabbing him, and he's swerving, and he misses the pizza dude, but the pizza dude hits a tree, and all the pizzas come spilling out on the lawn.
The pizza's the important... Because they set up the pizza earlier, and so that is an important factor in this final scene here.
I mean, if you put a bunch of pizzas in a van in the first act... They got to spill out everywhere in the third act.
It wasn't the first act when they did that, Dan. That would be some...
Fine, it was the second act.
That would be some cold pizza, Dan. Because that was days ago. Literally days ago, Dan.
Well, maybe it's one of those really slow, like, belt-driven pizza oven things that they put it in. It just took a while to get through there.
It's a little early for the slow food movement. But, so they... they got... Anyone familiar with the slow food movement will know that's not how slow food works. But they'll slowly come to that realization. And so it's big dramatic action set piece, and Hanks is out of there, and he's got the cop, and he's like, citizens arrest, citizens arrest! Just very, very enthusiastic about it. And for some reason, people believe him initially, but I'm assuming that's just because he doesn't have a weird accent like the other guy. And then they... have the situation where the trunk has popped open on the doctor's car, and inside, Corey Feldman discovers that there are skulls and bones, because that's a great hiding place. Nobody looks in the trunk of cars ever, especially not police. They put a
tarp over it.
Yes, yeah, it's an invisibility tarp. Nobody sees through it except for Corey Feldman.
I mean, they weren't even remotely suspects at this point because somebody blew up their house. Like, they've got bigger things to deal with.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's why they were so certain about taking the cops to their house, is that their own car would not be searched in that process, because their car is where all the incriminating stuff was.
You know what they say? Yeah, keep your enemies close and your evidence closer. I don't know how that works.
That was good, Dan. I like that.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. No bones.
Just made that up.
Yeah, no bones about it. So they
you got any more skeleton puns?
No. I'm done ribbing you. But so they go through the whole thing, and they have the stuff with the things where they're just like, hey, so you're free now, because it doesn't matter that you were a vigilante justice person who took matters into his own hands and blew up a home in the suburbs and caused all this chaos. You can go run free in the wild, and you don't need a hospital anymore, Tom Hanks. Here's some Western, like, good guy music for you. And then we'll take away these evil people who killed all these other people who we wouldn't have found out about if it were not for your vigilante stuff. So everything's good in the end.
And then he goes on vacation with his wife.
That's weird. It's a weird
ending.
Which
is a bummer because Geraldo Rivera is going to come down and interview everyone.
Oh, God. When I heard that line, it was just like, eye roll. It's not.
Yeah, it's a good thing. He's not still around doing. Oh, wait. He's totally still around.
Yeah. Well. Thanks, Geraldo. And so the day is saved by being incredibly suspicious of your neighbors, learning that you shouldn't be, and then being sorry that you ever doubted yourself for suspecting other people, because the real moral of the story is that other people are killers. I don't know. Yeah.
The moral of the story is people that are different are usually murderers.
Yeah, I see, this is the part where I wish the movie hadn't like doubled back on itself, hadn't driven around the house island of this development, as it were, driven around the cul-de-sac. That they could have like stuck more to their guns of this actually being a case of all of these paranoid white people being horrible to other people who are in the neighborhood who are not like them. Hmm. But instead they chose
you think they should have like accidentally found out that like Art was the guy who murdered them all along?
Oh, or I mean, that would have been kind of funny, honestly.
Or Walter, probably.
Or Bruce Dern, or Bruce Dern's wife. That would have been even wackier.
underneath those flowers she was planting in the front yard in the very beginning of the movie is where she hid the bodies.
Yes.
Because if we learned anything from Secret Window, it's that you bury the bodies under the plants, and then they grow out of them.
Secret Window? I think you mean Rear Window?
No, I mean Secret Window, the one with Johnny Depp.
Oh. I meant the Alfred Hitchcock one.
Yeah, I meant the one where he eats a bunch of corn and has braces.
Okay. I didn't see that one. Isn't that the one that they said was not good? Or was that Ninth Gate? Or were they both not good? I don't really remember.
They're both not good. This one has John Turturro in it. And John Turturro has a hat, a very large hat, kind of a Pharrell hat.
It's okay. You said John Turturro. You fulfilled all of my questions.
Is this why you won't see Oh Brother? Because that movie's good.
No, he's not the reason why. I saw part of it, and it's just like so boring. There's something about that era in American history that I find dull and insipid, and I can't stand watching anything from that era.
Rye is literally turning over in his grave right now.
Well, he's not here, so that's what he gets. That's what you get for not showing up to a surprise recording of a podcast at our beck and call. Person who has a job at night that requires recording things. But
I don't know. He's not working. He's on vacation now.
Oh, well then screw him additionally reasons and the stuff. But
a boy named Boom even tweeted at him, and Rye said, he replied. So he's in a place where he can reply to tweets, but he can't show up to listen to our episode.
Oh, well then that's how you know he really doesn't care.
And unacceptable is what I say.
Yeah, unlike Boom, who obviously cares. B&B, thank you. Holla to B&B.
I'm pretty sure he fell asleep by now.
Oh, of course. Everyone fell asleep by now. I think I'm asleep. This is just me talking by autopilot.
I mean, it is 11:15, and basically everyone in the suburbs went to sleep an hour and a half ago.
Yes. Well, except for your one weird neighbors who are probably burning bodies right now.
You know, this is the thing. They're so consistent about the floodlights and the music that you honestly can't even tell when they're awake and when they're asleep.
Yes. What if they just have a whole array of floodlights in the basement that they use to burn bodies?
Oh, no, sorry. We don't have basements over here.
Well, where do you keep your scorpions?
pretty much anywhere. The walls, the ceiling, the bed, the bathroom.
Okay, well, maybe you should be very suspicious of that bathroom with the old style glass block tile that flickers every now and then. Maybe that flickering is something suspicious, Dan.
Did I actually tell you that my neighbor's bathroom window has glass block tile? Because it totally does.
No.
Did I tell you that or no?
No, you didn't. I was just thinking of the era that your development was built in. I was just like, that just seems like a reasonable piece of construction stuff that did I mention to you how much I hate glass block tile? Because
everyone does, but
it's in a lot of houses, Dan.
Our houses are identical, but they're flipped floor plans, so our master is next to their master. And luckily, our master does not have the glass blocks, but the master bathroom window of their house is like a 4-foot by 4-foot glass block window.
Well, do you hear when the magic happens, since you're so close to the master bedroom?
No. I can't hear it over the Maroon 5. Also, I don't think it's actually happening, so that's good.
Never mind. I was going to say something really dumb, and now I'm just going to just trail off by being an idiot and just ride that into the sunset.
Can we play some vaguely Western music for you?
Yes, please, do.
We'll play some Maroon 5 as you walk off into the sunset.
Mm-hmm.
Luckily, the sun sets in the opposite direction of this house, so I can walk into the sunset away from my idiot neighbors.
So, can you see the sunset through your glass block tile?
They probably can, yeah. So that's,
Wait. Back up. So you have identical floor plans. Does that mean you have glass block tile in your house?
No. That's what I said. So apparently that one additional element didn't make it into our house. So their window, which I know is the master bathroom, is glass block. Ours is just sort of this weird sort of... it almost looks like the popcorn ceiling equivalent of glass, but it's just kind of like fuzzy glass.
Oh, yeah. I know what you're talking about. That 1970s, like, privacy glass.
Yeah, privacy glass, probably. Yeah. It's what they make, like, shower doors out of these days.
Yeah. It's garbage stuff. But still better than glass block. You dodged that bullet. I was going to judge you harshly.
At our the original house that we lived in when we first moved to Arizona over in Chandler, I think when I was, like, 6, so it was definitely still... It was probably right around the time this movie came out. My dad redid the master bathroom, and he put in some nice black marble tile on the floor, and he put glass blocks in the window. Talk about the style of the time.
That is 80s.
Yeah, it was mostly black with white, you know, sort of the pattern of the marble in the tile.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah, I was at a... a special event this past weekend, and there was a bathroom that had a black porcelain toilet in it, and I was just like, this is not appropriate for any era, really. But
was the lid of this toilet covered in cocaine?
No. Well, I mean, if it was, I could probably see it, but instead I was more worried about all the things I couldn't see because it was black. So
that sounds like you.
Yeah. I'm sure, because, you know, who's to say how often that was cleaned? It was at a venue. I mean, it was a high-class, highbrow venue, but you never know. It's why you need the white glove treatment for toilets. I don't know where I was going with that. We're done. Yay! I don't know where this ended.
So the Burbs, you actually like this one, right? So
no, this is mediocre. I didn't hate it, but I don't resent you for making me watch it. But
I should hope not.
I feel like this is checked a box, and I don't need to revisit those ever.
Well, that is a shame, because there are a great many fun and enjoyable references to this movie and lines from this movie that I like to bring up from time to time that make me chuckle. So next time you catch yourself repeating a line from this movie, you will know that hashtag Dan was right. Oh, I can't believe I just said that.
Well, I can't believe you said it, and no one will use that on Twitter. So I'm very happy about that.
Wait, didn't we do a Team Dan, Team Joe thing for something one time?
Well, that was when we had our membership only entrance to the to the bar.
I thought we did something like that for an episode a long time ago too. But I still totally won that, didn't I?
Maybe. I think so. I don't know. You are more likable than I am. I will say that for sure.
I don't know about that. I talk more than you do. That's about it. No, actually, on the internet, I think I talk more than you do.
Yes.
On the internet, yes, but in real life, I talk way more.
Okay.
Remember, I just like randomly walk up to people and talk to them and try and find out what their day is like.
Well, yes. So,
hey, buddy, how long have you been working on this software? That's cool. Where are you from?
I'm already trying. Okay. I mean, I'm sitting right now, but I wanted to throw my chair back away and then go to the other side of the room. There's something repellent to me about talking to people that I don't like know on some level. So that I have an aversion to that.
It's kind of my job, though. Like the whole talking to actors thing, you got to kind of get to know them.
Oh, look at you.
Make them dance.
Fancy director, Dan.
No, there's nothing fancy about psychologically manipulating people into doing the thing you want them to do.
Yes, there is. Manipulation's the best part.
Hmm. Well, I call it a job.
Just think about all the things I manipulated you into doing.
Well, you made me buy this microphone.
Yes.
You made me feel bad about how echoey and crappy my microphone was.
Yes.
$40. I mean, how do you pass that up?
I don't know. That's what I keep telling people. Because one of the annoying things is that now that Marco's microphone review has come out, everyone's going to go, oh, well, Marco recommended this, so we can go ahead and buy this now. And I'll be like, hey, guys. Hey, back here. Over here. I said this like 6 months ago, and all y'all told me that you were going to go buy Yetis instead. So congratulations, all of you people. See, you could have saved $60.
It really, his post really just reminded me to check the price again, which had gone down from the last time.
What is our show?
It's an internet phone call where we say stupid things.
Okay, good. Cause,
and then we preserve them for all time.
That's the part I'm not sure about.
Mm-hmm.
Why did we do that last thing, Dan?
Because we are content creators.
We shouldn't do that. That's bad. Then we gotta sell like FanDuel or something, don't we? Isn't that how that works?
There is one of the movie channels on my DirecTV. Almost 24 hours a day has something with regards to fantasy football. I think it's that FanDuel thing, and I would never click on that. But it's on all the time, and they're sponsoring literally everything.
I know that's mainly the source of my comment was the
they're the new Squarespace, basically, aren't they?
Yeah, Squarespace, but for gambling. So.
The fast and easy way to lose all of your money and your family and your self-respect.
Oh, goodness. Anyway, this podcast doesn't endorse that. We just endorse stamps.com with the code WTF.
Yeah, I should check to see if the most recent episodes of WTF have been sponsored by FanDuel.
They probably have.
I'll have to update my impression.
Well, for listeners of this episode who are not familiar with Dan's impression of... Mr. WTFs of the pods. It is very good. It is a good impression.
What episode was that? Was that Starship Troopers? That wasn't Starship Troopers.
No. It was one you edited. I did Starship Troopers. I think it was the one after that. And I like.
Did I edit? I think you edited it.
I edited Starship Troopers.
No, I thought. I don't know.
Yeah, I edited Starship Troopers because that's the one I put the Millennium Falcon noise in.
Yes, I remember that. I thought you edited the entire episode of the one where I did the thing.
No. I just took the clip out of it because you weren't going to post it on the internet. And I was like, I'm going to post it on the internet. And then, you know, none of our lazy listeners ever did that thing with that music that we asked them to do.
Probably because I didn't specifically excise that clip for them.
Oh, so Dan, what are you trying to say? Are you saying it's not our wonderful, valuable listeners' fault and instead it might be our own fault?
No, I'm saying it's specifically their fault because they couldn't bother to cut it out of the episode. They needed us to cut it out for them. We got to spoon feed these people. Actually, if you scroll back up in the chat room, this boy named Boomgod, he made a reference to GIF Peanut Butter Azure.
Oh, thank goodness.
Hi.
Oh, so that was Labyrinth then. That was the episode.
Well, he made, I think.
No. It was definitely the same episode.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if it was the same episode as GIF Peanut Butter Escher,
yes,
which is still the greatest title in the history of podcasting.
Okay, again, I want to cut back to, what is this podcast? And do you think someone has listened to this for the first time, the very first time, and they got to this point and they're like, wow, what did we do?
We'll put this in the after dark or something after the music or whatever. But yeah, I think that is a possibility because we got a few tweets of people saying that this is a movie that they like and potentially this podcast might have a slightly larger reach than some of the other ones. So yeah, this could be somebody's first episode and they will probably spend the next 2 hours in the fetal position wondering what the hell they just heard.
Well, get out of your fetal position, because imagine if you took the Flophouse and you made it not funny and you subtracted one person from it. I don't know, probably Dan McCoy or Stuart, but probably Dan McCoy. And then
which one of us is Elliot?
I think I'm Elliot. That's pretty obvious.
So you're Elliot. What am I then?
I thought you were Stuart.
Am I the cat?
I think, yeah. Well, Stuart's the cat.
Oh.
Yeah.
Which one drinks?
Well, Stuart, but Dan too. So but not Elliot. But that doesn't make any sense anymore. So then maybe we're... Maybe I'm Dan and you're Stuart and no one is Elliot because this show isn't that popular.
but if you're Dan and I'm Joe and this is still our podcast, but we do it differently.
That's got really confusing because I don't know him.
With the things and stuff. Mm-hmm. And they do the stuff with the things and the... Damn it, you have another one. I can't remember. I think we need to cut this off.
The end.
I died.
Anyone listening in the chat room, we're really sorry.